It's time for the Car Doctor on AM 950 WROL. Got a car question? Call us at 617-770-3030. That's 617-770-3030. Now, here's the Car Doctor, John Paul, on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston.
And good Saturday morning, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Car Doctor on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston, or FM 100.3. You can give us a listen there if you're in the metro Boston area, or, of course, on the WROL app. You can go to any app store, look for WROL Radio. You can find it. There is all kinds of things to find. We're on a couple minutes early today because we are. It was an interesting week this week. Usually I do, I'll be honest, 8 minutes of show prep a week, I think. I did none this week. I do a little bit more. I actually try to find articles that I find interesting and look through as I get some email magazines and things. I'll look through them and try to find something. But with the Monday holiday, kind of took that out. Tuesday, I taught one of our driver improvement classes in Woonsocket, Rhode Island. And that pretty much, that's a five-hour part of the day that I missed. Had to write columns for the Boston Globe and the Providence Journal. Somewhere in there.
Wait, isn't it just one article that you write and you just send it to the...
No, it's two different. Yeah, it is different. And I don't think anyone cares, but originally 10 or 12 years ago when I wrote for the Journal, they wanted it to be unique content. So I actually have to write two different articles.
Wow.
And occasionally does a Globe article end up in the Journal months later? Yeah, it might. I'll be honest, it does. But their search engine optimization, I don't think, is that good. But, you know, it might end up that way, or the names are changed to protect the innocent kind of thing. So, you know, what looked like a really good question with the Chevy owner might be a Buick owner later on or something.
But, same difference.
Yeah, yeah. So that does happen. That was Tuesday. Wednesday, I don't know, I did something else. Which took up most of the day. Thursday, we had a staff meeting, which takes up half the day, it seems like. Thursday night, I actually went to an event at the Seaport Hotel, or Seaport Trade Center, parked at the Seaport Hotel. And that was, Wednesday night, I was at an advisory board meeting for Blue Hills Regional Vocational Technical School, where I'm kind of winding down a little bit. I was the chairman of their advisory board, and now I'm not. So, just taking a step back. Still go to meetings. Still go to a couple meetings, but taking a step back. And being the chairman just means you go to maybe one or two more meetings. But I belong to five different advisory boards. And if I go to three meetings each a year, that's 15 weeks out of, you know, 52? So that's, yeah, out of 52. So that means at least every third week I'm doing something. So, kind of stepping back a little bit, trying to rest a little bit. But on Thursday night, I went to this New England Council dinner with 1,600 of my closest friends. And they gave out awards to, you know, the governor was there. He gave out an award to Nikki Tsongas. There was a lot of interesting things going on at this event, and it was great to see a lot of people, and it was all good. So there was that, and I'll talk about more some of the guest speakers that were there. There were some pretty interesting people that were there as well, and with the one exception of they serve, you know, when you serve 1,700 people. Is there a chance that maybe some of the food could have had a problem?
Yeah.
And I woke up around 1:30 in the morning and didn't feel that well. So I emailed one of the people I was with, "Did you feel okay last night?" And he's like, "Not great." Then I saw somebody else the next day. I'm like, "Did you feel okay that next day?" And he's like, "That night?" And he's like, No, not really. So, and then I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to drive to Stamford, Connecticut to be there. So, hey, with us on the phone is Matt Williams. He is the Director of Business Development for the Hartz Corporation. And it's kind of a rainy day here in Boston. The days looked better than it really was when it started off, but it's kind of a rainy day now. But this is maybe some of the time where people think about putting their cars away for the wintertime and maybe cleaning up their convertible cars. And Matt works for Hartz Corporation, and they are the oldest top material manufacturer anywhere. Matt, good morning, and welcome to the Car Doctor program here in Boston.
Good morning, John Paul. How are you?
I'm just fine. You know, and you're a Massachusetts guy. Is it look rainy and dark and miserable where you are?
It's worse than rain, John Paul. It's cold, wet rain.
Yeah.
As I'm sure you can appreciate this time of year, temperatures dropping, and this is the kind of day where we like to think that folks appreciate that the convertible top over their head, it's doing its job and keeping them dry and warm inside.
That's right. That's right. And the days of, I remember many, many years ago, I owned an MGB. It was probably the most fun car I owned and the worst car I ever owned. I met a lot of people broken down by the side of the road. It had all the typical Lucas Electronics problems, and it had a relatively new convertible top on it, which kept you sort of dry. Convertible tops have changed a lot over the years, and you know, my wife has driven a convertible for her last three cars, and the latest one is a Volkswagen Beetle, which has a Hartz roof on it, I believe.
Absolutely, yeah, and if you look at the comparison of that old MG to what Volkswagen is doing today on vehicles like the Beetle, the difference is fantastic. So if it's the topping material that we provide that is more durable and lasts longer before cracking and letting water in, or you look at the window seals for the back window and how well they're integrated and how tight that seal is so that window doesn't leak, or even the door seals. They do a lot more testing and development on these systems today, and the end result is a vehicle that is truly four-season functional and something that consumers tend to get a lot more use out of year-round.
Yeah, people find this hard to believe, but I don't have a garage, so my cars have to sit outside, and the convertibles have sat outside over the years and have actually stood up pretty well. This most recent one had a problem, but it had nothing to do with the top. It had to do with when the car was manufactured, they had a clearance problem, so when the top went up and down, it actually rubbed against itself and caused an issue and was taken care of under warranty, so that was all good. But the... they do require some maintenance, and whether it's a vinyl roof or a cloth-style roof, they do require some maintenance, and you don't want to go out there with spick and span and Lest Oil and try to clean a convertible top, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So the coated fabrics that we supply are very unique and have some very specific performance properties that we like to maintain even after the car gets cleaned. So we definitely recommend folks against going into your traditional car wash, whether it be an automatic or even a manned car wash, but something where we want to avoid those very nasty detergents and even some of the waxes that are applied on the cars in those car washes.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the high-pressure water jets aren't a good thing for a convertible top. So while it may take a little more time, we ultimately do recommend that convertible owners spend the extra time to hand wash their car in their top and use some very, very specific guidelines in cleaning the fabric of the roof. Hartz has tested and endorsed a product by the name of Ragtop, which is a very good combination of a cleaning product that lifts the soil and other debris out of the fabric. We recommend you use Ragtop along with a soft bristle brush. They actually manufacture a brush that we've tested as well that does very well and helps lift that dirt out of there using warm water outside on a nice sunny day is a good time to do it. And after you clean the top, the very important thing that we also recommend is that you reapply a protectant layer. So as delivered from Hartz and the OEMs from the factory, that fabric has a water repellent finish on it for a cloth top especially. And that water repellent finish is what helps the water bead up and not allow it to soak in and bring the dirt and debris back into the fabric after it gets dirty again. So reapplying that water repellent finish is something you should always do on your cloth top after you clean it, and that'll help it to look better longer so you don't have to clean it as often and keep it from getting those wear spots, kind of like what you were talking about on your Volkswagen Beetle.
Now, by water repellent finish, do you mean like the same kind of stuff you spray on furniture to spill beads up kind of stuff?
That kind of stuff, yeah. So these are typically fluorocarbon finishes. We've engineered this one specifically to dry and perform at a very low temperature on the surface of the fabric. It's not the same type of product that we would use in our manufacturing at Hartz, but it's just a different formulation that allows consumers to use it. It's very safe. It's in a spray can, and you just do a couple of light coats over the surface of the material. It's safe. If it get a little bit on the paint or on the glass, it'll wipe right off. But you let that sit outside on a sunny day, and it'll warm up a little bit and provide a nice water repellent finish back on that roof, almost as good as the day came from the factory.
And is that your branded or is that Ragtop too?
So Ragtop, it's their product. We tested and endorsed it. So we have an affiliation with them at the endorsement level, but nothing beyond that.
But they're the ones that also make the water repellent finish too, right?
That's correct.
Yep.
So if you go to the website, or search online, for example, for Ragtop, RAGGTOPP, you'll find it. And there's a link to their site from Hartz website and the pages that we have for convertible top cleaning as well. So consumers can get at it from the Hartz website too.
Yep. And, you look through, if you look through magazines like Hemmings Motor News and you look back at some old antique tops, old antique cars, and you'll notice things like has a Hartz top. Hartz has been in this business for a long time, haven't they?
Yeah, we have history that dates back to 1897 overall, but our North American operations date to the early aughts of the 20th century, and we're a third-generation family-owned company, and the Hartz family today has continued to invest in the business and keep us at the forefront of the automotive trim marketplace, and we're very proud to continue to support open-air driving and motoring overall.
And you guys are a worldwide corporation providing top material to all of the largest vehicle manufacturers, as well as some interior materials and things like that. And oddly enough, you're located here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's the great thing we feel about what we've been able to do over the last 100 plus years. Again, the Hartz family is from Massachusetts and New England to begin with, and they've maintained their roots here and want to maintain it moving forward. And while it may seem odd, there's no car manufacturing facilities here. There are a few people like Hartz that are still manufacturing subcomponents and parts for cars, and that's what we do, and we're very proud of it.
And there's a company that does a lot of interior work in old cars, and whose name I can't think of. What are they? They're here in New England, and you provide some of the old interior materials as well, right?
Yep. You're thinking of LeBaron and Bond?
Yes.
Up in Eamesbury, yes. They're a great group up there, and we supply topping fabrics and some other accessory parts for convertible roof systems to those guys, and they do a great job of servicing the market, the restoration and vintage marketplace with trim materials. So, yeah, definitely a resource for folks that are out there restoring their old cars.
Yeah, and it's a pretty interesting company because it is this worldwide company. You make materials for everything. It seems like everything that has a roof that falls down, and you're worldwide and headquartered here in Massachusetts, which I think makes the company a pretty special company. And I remember talking to talking to Doug Hartz one time about, we were talking about interior materials, and we were talking about leather finishes versus some of the other materials. And he's like, well, you have to remember, it's a little like the Bob Store commercial when they talk about, you know, leather any place you sit. And he says, you know, think of that sometimes with some of the interiors of cars that may say it's got it's leather seating material. He said, chances are, depending on the car, we make the sides and the bottoms and the places where you may not actually be sitting, but the rest of it is our material.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was something that the OEMs started a while ago and continue to do today. When people ask for a real leather seat or trim part, in a lot of cases it's the part that's physically touching their body, and whether it's the bolsters or the headrests or the armrests or some other portion of that seat assembly, those will typically be done in a synthetic leather, so not a true leather, but a plastic artificial leather, if you will, manufactured by folks like Hartz. And the funny thing is, at the end of the day on this, John Paul, is that the durability and quality level and consistency and even emissions of different chemicals that go into manufacturing our synthetic leathers are a lot better and more environmentally friendly and last longer than real leather. So people, you know, may still want real leather, and that's certainly a viable option, but the technology with plastic-based synthetic leather products has evolved to the point where it's a superior product and more environmentally friendly, and they'll get a much longer life out of it.
Yeah, no, it's again, it's very interesting, and your website has all kinds of information about the company. Also, mm-hmm. You think about manufacturing, especially the manufacturing you're in. Yours is a pretty green company, a pretty environmentally friendly company for a company that you think about some of the materials and chemicals that go into making all kinds of various componentry, especially interior and exterior components of cars, could be pretty tough on the environment. But you guys do a really good job of staying really green.
Yeah, so you know, the family is committed to that and doing as much as we can to invest in equipment that's energy efficient or facilities that are energy efficient. And two examples of that is that, you know, going back and comparing 2015 versus 2000, we've reduced the total amount of CO2 produced per yard of fabric that we process at our facility by 22.5%.
Wow.
So over a 15-year lifetime span, we evolved the technology and the equipment in our facility and the efficiency of that equipment to reduce by over 22% the amount of CO2 per yard of product that we manufacture.
Yeah,
and we've done other things with LED lighting and solar energy consumption on our site, and also with you know, some of the emissions controls on our equipment to really minimize our impact upon the environment at our facility here in Massachusetts.
No, it sounds like an interesting story all the way around, and I just really enjoy the idea that, you know, Massachusetts years and years ago was you know, an automotive manufacturer, certainly, and we actually made a lot of things in Massachusetts. We don't make as many now, but the idea that there's this company that supports other companies around the world located right here in Massachusetts is pretty amazing, and I encourage people to go to Hartz website to learn more about it. It's HAARTZ.com, and learn a little bit more about what Hartz does, and maybe even get some tips on how to maintain your top, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So a lot of the information about our company and our environmental stewardship is on the site, but within the exteriors trim section of our webpage, there's some a lot of information about the convertible car top products and a set of cleaning guides, going back to our conversation earlier about car care here going into the winter. Convertibles, there's information there about ragtop and specific procedures on how to clean and maintain your top.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you guys have come up with some new technology to be able to do things like even put striping in a top now. So if it's an original equipment manufacturer and they want to put, you know, it's a BMW Mini convertible and they want to put the Union Jack flag on it, you guys can figure out mm-hmm. a way to do that, right?
Absolutely, John Paul. Yeah, we have innovated a modification of the jacquard weaving technology, which, interestingly enough, jacquard weaving is one of the earliest forms of the computer to control a weaving loom, and modified that to give us the ability to put images on the roofs in a very durable fashion, and we can cover the entire roof of a car with a characteristic logo of the OEM or even things like the Union Jack flag.
Yeah.
We've written words, done stripes, we've done all kinds of different patterns. The American flag, for example, in a roof, we've done that. So there's a lot of unique things we can do with that that gives the OEMs the ability to express their design intent on the car.
And again, that website is haartz.com. It's HAARTZ.com, and you can find out more information there and find out everything about it. And your PR agency sent me a bio of you, and you worked at Los Alamos National Labs?
Yeah, for one summer, John Paul. That's an interesting opportunity. Maybe one day over a cold beer, I can share some stories there.
All right, okay, I wasn't sure whether you could even share that. You know, it could be super secret stuff, you know, so.
No, not super secret, but it was an interesting facility, and security was a big deal out there. So, yeah. It was a great experience.
I bet. Hey, Matt, thanks for taking time out of your Saturday morning. Hopefully you don't have to go to a soccer game or something outside where it's cold and wet and miserable. So,
No, I wouldn't. And if anybody's out there with a convertible today, think about how it's keeping you dry and warm, because that's certainly our job.
There you go. Hey, Matt, thanks a lot, and talk to you soon.
All right, take care. Thanks, John Paul.
Bye-bye. That was Matt Williams. He is the Director of Business Development for the Haartz Corporation. We've had him on before. We've had Doug Haartz on before. It's an interesting company just because the facility itself is massive, and they're located in Massachusetts. They're just here in Massachusetts, and it's just...
Where?
I could tell you that if I actually remembered. Did I mention I haven't gotten a lot of sleep this week? I want to say it's in Greenfield, but hang on. Acton, Mass.
Oh, that's where I get my tattoo done.
Oh, there you go.
That's where my tattoo artist is.
You can go find their global headquarters. They also have an operation in Germany, in Detroit. Germany looks like a manufacturing operation. Detroit. They also have a manufacturing operation in... some place I can't pronounce.
Okay.
And Tokyo and China. So, but their global headquarters and one of their biggest manufacturing spots is here right in Acton, Massachusetts.
Excellent.
Where? I have no idea what it even says. It's Haartz Automotive. Oh, it's in India. Okay. But it didn't actually list the country. Like the other one says, you know, Changwing, China, something. It says the name of the town. The other one says Tokyo. This one just says the village of something. I don't know. Anyway. Yeah, so...
radio.
yeah. It's going to be a weird show today. I'm exhausted. Like I said, on Thursday, I went to this event at the Seaport, and it was really good. And one of the award recipients, and they give out awards, is a veteran, maybe he's like 30 years old, and unfortunately back about 6 years ago when he was in Iraq, he put his backpack down on an IED and it exploded, and 2 weeks later he woke up in a hospital with no arms and no legs. And he said to his wife, and they had a child, he said, you know, take whatever money you have and just leave me here. And, you know, his first thoughts were, you know, why did I even survive? He was absolutely, you know, anything that was wrong with you and you talked to him didn't matter anymore. And he was a stand-up comedian. He was, I didn't think he was going to be. I thought he was going to get up and say thanks and whatever. And you know, and he was wearing a polo shirt and shorts. And... he had one mechanical arm, no other arm, mechanical legs. And he said, yeah, somebody said to me, you look a little casual to be here up in a polo shirt and shorts. And he's like, hey, if I took my legs off, there'd be pants. And he just went on like one after another like that and, you know, made no one feel uncomfortable. He was just funny as could be, but he set up a foundation. He lives up in Maine. He set up a foundation where veterans who have been hurt and are trying to adjust, he'll teach them how to snowboard, canoe, kayak, you know, do all kinds of things. He has, I guess he has horses on his property, teach him how to go horseback riding. Him and his wife run this thing. He says they probably have about 30 weeks a year. They have people at their house. And just an amazing guy. And then I went home and got home about 10, went to bed shortly thereafter, and didn't feel so well at 1. Again, 1,700 plates of chicken out at the same time might have been a problem. But then the good news is I had to be up at 4 anyway because I had to leave to go to Stamford, Connecticut, which is like 200 and some odd miles from my house, to go to a conference that AAA was running at the University of Connecticut campus in Stamford.
So, and, stop. Let me get this straight. You drove 200 and some odd miles with very little sleep.
I got like a couple hours, three.
And
not feeling
not
well?
Feeling well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you work doing what you do. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I felt better by the end of the day, except last night when I was pretty tired. But it was a conference all about autonomous vehicles, but it was more geared towards not people like me, more geared towards municipalities. So there was Senator Blumenthal, the senator in Connecticut, was there. There was another senator that was there talking about how their views on autonomous vehicles are. I don't know the senators, so they seem pretty informed. There was a lot of people from different municipalities that were there to see how autonomous vehicles are going to influence what they have to do as they're designing things. Connecticut wants to, like everybody else, they want to be like Boston, where we're doing autonomous vehicle development now in the Seaport and out of Devens. And supposedly Weymouth, at the whatever they're calling the old Weymouth Navy base today, Union Point.
Yeah, Union Point.
Apparently there's an autonomous shuttle that's supposed to run from Union Point to the park and ride. I haven't seen it yet. You might like the name.
What is it?
Optimus Ride.
Oh, you did tell me this before. Yeah.
So, but yeah. So they're supposed to be running the shuttle. I have not seen the shuttle there. I've actually gone there at sort of peak commuter time, going, come on, I just want to see the shuttle with no driver, and I haven't seen it yet. And I was telling somebody, I think I've been flagged by Lyft as being a bad customer because I've tried to get the Lyft autonomous car to come pick me up in the Seaport. So I've like made a couple Lyft reservations and canceled them when it wasn't the autonomous Lyft showing up.
Okay.
So I'm not a good customer, I guess. So, and you can't request the autonomous one, you know, so, and it doesn't run every day and, you know, so, but I thought it'd be fun to go for a ride in it, but. But anyway, so I went and did that and came home last night. And after that, you know, it was just one of those things. So it's been a busy week. Came home and got a very official looking letter about my wife's car, about how her warranty was expiring and how we should sign up for this warranty program. And it makes it look like you have to do it. They don't even tell you how much it costs. They just, you know, do you want this? Do you want this? Do you want this? Throw those things away, people, if you get them. Because the big problem is who the warranty company really is. Are they going to be around in a year? You know, people ask me about the AAA warranty. And we got into the warranty business because people asked us to. Not as a business line. It was people asked us to. Because at AAA, and you talk to most any consumer people, they'll tell you extended warranties are not necessarily a good investment. Some people have had great luck with them. Other people have not. But we looked around and we found a company that does a good job. And even over the years, companies have come in and out of our business and we've always stood behind it. So even if we had GE Capital once for a warranty company, they decided to get out of the business at that time. And we had you know, thousands of AAA members that had extended warranties. Well, if anything came up until we got the next company online, we would take care of it. We would actually step in and take care of the problem. You're not going to get that with some of these companies that you don't know anything more about than just a postcard in the mail. The factory company, sure, if you bought a Toyota and you want to get Toyota Extra Care and you want to get it through Toyota, good way to go. You know what you're going to get. But if you want a third party, I would not recommend anybody but, and sounds a little self-serving, but I wouldn't recommend anybody but AAA's warranty, because I know that I've been there for 33 years. We've had a warranty for 25 of those 33 years, and we've always stood behind it. And even to the point where we can argue with the warranty company, if they say this should be covered, this shouldn't be covered, we can look at it and go, yeah, maybe it should be. And they'll agree with us because they kind of have to. So we're able to do that. So it's a good way to be able to do that. If I have a PowerPoint now about autonomous vehicles, and if you're somebody who would like me to come out and talk about autonomous vehicles with your Rotary Club or Kiwanis or something, be happy to do that. Just drop me an email at jpaul@aaanortheast.com. Not the month of November. Crazy busy over the next 6 weeks or so with a bunch of things that we have going on at AAA. But if you want to do something in December or January or some point after that, and you would like me to come out, and if you have a Rotary Club or, I don't know, chamber lunch or breakfast, or and you're looking for a 20-minute to a half-hour presentation about autonomous vehicles, kind of at a level where there isn't, you know, we're not going to talk about really, really specific details, you can feel free to, again, drop me an email at jpaul@aaanortheast.com, and happy to come out and see what's going on. Also, Dennis is working on the phones. Also, we have a couple things coming up over the next month or two, starting with auto show season. In fact, today, not right this minute, but today we're going to be giving away some tickets to the Connecticut Auto Show. And this time, the Connecticut Auto Show is going to be at Mohegan Sun. So if
you sold. Give me them.
Wow.
I win. No one else does.
All
no.
right.
Just All kidding. Right. No. Yeah. Just kidding.
Do you like Mohegan?
I do like Mohegan Sun. Because I don't go often. I haven't been in years, actually, but I like it.
Because of the Native American heritage?
I don't have Native American heritage.
No, I said because of it, not yours.
No, I just think that I like the design of it. I think it has a much more like relaxed atmosphere than the other place.
The other place, whatever the other one's called. Foxwoods.
Foxwoods. Yeah. I know what the other place was. I just didn't want to say.
Have you been to the one in Springfield?
No, I've not.
No? I saw it on TV the other day. You can't find it. They blended it into downtown Springfield. They didn't want it to look like a casino. They made it look very traditional to the area. So we will be giving away some tickets to that. And after the first of the year, and we can give these away sooner than later, we have tickets to both the New England Auto Show, which is going to take place January 17th to the 21st, and the RV and Camping Expo, which takes place simultaneously almost from the 18th to the 21st. So auto show from the 17th to the 21st in January, RV and camping show, 18th to the 21st. RV show is, if you just want to go and like open cabinet doors and look at big RVs and figure out that they don't look like tents anymore, and it is pretty fascinating. But the idea that the Connecticut auto show is at Mohegan, I bet that's going to get the numbers up. And they always did pretty well at the Connecticut Auto Show. It was always a nice little show, but now it's changed. So if you want more information, it's ctautoshow.com, and we will be giving away tickets to that today. But right now, let's talk to Tom in Weymouth. Tom, good morning.
Good morning, John. A question. You know, you see a lot of people that sell older cars, so some of them kind of do it as a little side business. So you go to look at one, say a 70s. But what I've seen in the past is they have a title, but they never change the title in their name. Say they bought it from somebody in Rhode Island or Connecticut. Then they bring it up, and then that title is really not in their name. It's in somebody else's name, but they never got it filled out. So or they just want to pass you that title. What do you think about that as a legal?
For the buyer, it's wrong on all kinds of levels, but it's not that wrong, I guess. If any car, no matter what car it is, has to have a if I bought a car from you,
right,
and within 7 days I went to go get an inspection sticker and it failed the sticker, and I could come back to you and say, you know what, it's going to cost me, I bought the car for $2,000, it's going to cost me $500 to fix it because the ball joints are bad and, I don't know, the muffler has a hole in it. Mm-hmm. And I could go back to you and say, Tom, you got to either give me my money back or pay for the cost of the repair.
Right.
And if the car technically came from Dennis instead of Tom, you could go, no, don't. And if I tried to sue you, they'd say there would be no real record that I bought the car from you. It would just show that I bought it from Dennis. And that's right. Where the problem is. The second thing that happens is you've left the Commonwealth of Massachusetts out of their money-making opportunity. Because when you buy a car from somebody in Rhode Island with the idea of selling it to me and you don't register it in between,
right,
Massachusetts doesn't get the sales tax money.
Right.
And they don't like that.
No, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, and the only ones who can avoid doing that is a car dealer, you know, an actual car dealer, you know,
right.
You know, ABC Auto Sales, you know, they just take the title, you sign it, and because they're a dealer, they're able to, they have to pay separate taxes, but they take that original title and sell it to me, and that's how it's done. But a private party sale, you are supposed to register the car.
Right.
Or minimally get the title in your name, and to get the title in your name, you have to pay the sales tax on the cost of the vehicle.
Right, but in the legalities, like I said, you know, an older car, vintage car, you're buying a 79 Pontiac something or whatever, and the person says, I went down, like, I got this in Connecticut because he knew somebody got a real good buy and sell it to you for twice as much, and he says, I have the title here, but it's in John Smith's name, and I'm, you know, Ed Conley, but I can just, you know, sign their name. They probably never signed it. I mean, it's not 100%, I would imagine, legal, right? So you as a buyer.
Yeah, there's a little bit of buyer beware in there. Does it happen?
Yeah.
Does it happen every single day? Yeah. Happens every single day.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, if you know what you're buying, and the other part of it is, if, you know, if Dennis decides he wants to be a corner used car dealer. So he wants to put a car out in his front yard, you know, once or twice a month and try to sell it and make a little bit of money. If you sell more than, I think it's 5 cars a year or 3 cars a year, one or the other, you have to apply to get a used car dealer's license. So so what people are doing is the old term, and I don't know how relevant it is anymore, they used to call it curbstoners. Because they were like literally selling cars at a curb, and they were doing just that. So, you know, it's prevalent enough where somebody came up with a nickname for it.
Yeah,
I even saw a car that was, and I don't remember what it was. I think it might have been a Honda or something. And I think it was here in Quincy that somebody said, you know, I have this Honda Accord for sale for $1,000. And the person said, yeah, I'm really interested in it. He said, well, I'll meet you at the Stop and Shop on the Southern Artery at 7 o'clock tonight. Mm-hmm. And the guy said, okay. He said, I'll be over by the Bank of America ATM. And come to find out, the guy actually had an auction. So there was like 20 people that showed up to look at this $1,000 car. And he said, no, I'm not selling it for $1,000. I'm selling it for the best offer, and I'll do it right now. Who wants to bid $1,100, $1,200? And this guy said, no, I wanted to buy a car for $1,000. I didn't know it was an auction. And the guy called me up and said, how legal is that? And I said, I don't know that it is or isn't, actually, but it's pretty novel. So, you know, there's all kinds of shenanigans out there. But the idea, if you had a car that I was interested in, and you let's just say, for instance, that you inherited it through, you know, some relative passed away, and it, and you and they and the relative said, "Here's the title to the car. You know, I signed, you know, Uncle Jerry's name on the bottom of it, which isn't legal either. But you know, and he wanted you to have the car, and you decided you didn't want the car. You were going to sell it, and I said to you, hey, I'm really interested in that car. It's a, you know, it's a nice, you know, Toyota Corolla, and you don't want a lot of money for it, and I'm looking for just a dependable second car. You know, could I buy it, register it, be happy with it? Sure.
Sure, but yeah. I worried, like, one time I bought something, and the brother had it, and he had the title, and when I, you know, he was selling it for him. I'm just saying, so.
Yep.
But when I come to terms, and I said, well, it's really your brother's motorcycle, that it was
right.
What it was.
Yep.
And it's not really in your name. Yep. You're selling it. So what if you sell it to me? Why can't your brother have recourse coming back to me after I purchased and say, well, you knew it wasn't me.
Right. There's always,
you know what I'm saying? You could have some liability.
There always is that concern that, you know, this is probably an urban legend more than anything else, but, you know, the, you know, you see the, you know, 2008 Mercedes-Benz SL for sale for $5,000, which is, you know, $50,000 less than it should sell for. And the person bought the car and showed up, and there was a woman there, and she said, yeah, I'm selling my husband's car. I want $5,000 for it. And the person goes, well, that's an awfully good deal. And she says, yeah, we're getting divorced, and I hate him, and I'm selling his car. And, you know, could he come back and say, wait, she had no authority to sell my car for $5,000? And she can say, well, the idea was we're supposed to split the proceeds, and, you know, the car was worth $50,000, but you're only getting $2,500 out of it because I hate you, you know. And then could he sue you and say, well, she didn't have the authority to sell the car, and you have it? I suppose. I mean, I've heard that story multiple times with divorces, and is it, you know, I don't even know if it's true, but it could be a problem. Now, I never heard any follow-up of it other than, you know, somebody ended up with a Mercedes for a really, really cheap price, but.
Right. I guess, so, I mean, there is a potential there. It's probably very limited that it happens, but
right.
It is a little window there. That on the extended warranty, you're right. I get them now. You get them after a certain age because they're scare tactics.
Yep,
and
absolutely.
It's funny how they word it, and they say, you are responsible for your vehicle warrant. You know, they word it so that if you don't know anything, you know, I can imagine a lot of people say, oh, my God, we have to do this. You know,
you're responsible for everything. You know, if your car gets a flat tire, you're responsible, you know.
But they hide the wheels
They absolutely do. They absolutely do. Hey, Tom, we always learn something whenever we talk
with
each other.
John.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
I think we have Richard on the phone. Richard, good morning.
Good morning, John Paul. Listen, I got up this morning and I started my car. It's a 2013 Nissan Altima, if that means anything. And the sign came up on the message board, loose fuel cap.
Oh, okay.
Now, it wasn't loose yesterday when I stopped, you know, when I parked the car.
Yeah.
And now, I don't know if this is relevant or not, but yesterday morning, after having run the car and done a couple of errands, when I got back into it, it said not key identified or whatever the terminology they use is. And I had to wait and start four or five times to try and get the car to start. And then it finally did start. It has done that before, not within the last 6 months, but it has done that before where it refuses to recognize the key, even though it's in the same place, you know, on the fob, it's a push button.
Yep.
Now, the roof fuel cap, my question is, I'm going to have to go to the dealer to get rid of this?
No. No, what I would do is, you know, go get, you know, if you need gas, go get gas. If you don't, take the gas cap off, put it back on again, tighten it up, and drive around for a few days and see if the light goes out.
Just for a few days, because I've already done that. The first thing I did was take the gas cap off.
Yeah, how full is the gas tank?
Just a little over three quarter.
Okay. When it's, here's kind of what happens. There's a pump that actually pressurizes the fuel system to check to see if there's any leaks, fumes leaking out of the system. And generally, if it's over 3/4 and under 1/4, it doesn't test. So you're right in that window where it's going to start to test it. So it may have detected the cap was loose, but it may have been just enough not to retest the system. You're not causing any harm specifically.
Okay.
So
I that would, was the question. Yeah,
I would drive it. You know, I would drive it for a little while and, you know, wait till it gets down to, you know, you need to buy gas again and see if the light goes out. If it doesn't go out, then I would, you could go someplace and just have them clear the light so they'll hook a scanner up to it and shut the light off. Or or you can go to the dealer and have them look at it. And how many miles are in the car?
64,007.
Okay.
And, of course, it's now 4,700 miles. Over the extended warranty.
Yeah, but and I would have to look, but the emissions, the evaporative emissions controls, which is what this is part of, might actually be 8 years and 80,000.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it might be. Some are 3 years, some are 6 years, some are 8 years, depending on what component it is. Now, a gas cap is kind of a little bit. Now, it could be the gas cap, the seal on the gas cap just isn't any good anymore. But it could be just that. It could have been the what the system looks for. It looks for a large evaporative emissions leak. So a large evap leak. Usually a large evap leak is caused by a loose gas cap or a gas cap that's not on there. And what it does, it has to go through a cycle. It has to periodically retest itself. And if it retests itself and it looks like everything's good, it'll shut the light off on its own. In fact, I know a guy who runs a repair shop, and he has kind of an interesting view, and not all his customers like it. Somebody will come in with a problem with the check engine light that's on, and he'll say, and they'll go to get back in the car, and he'll say to him, the customer will come back and go, the check engine light's still on. And he'll say, yeah, I know it's still on. And he'll go, but I don't want the light on. He says, I want to make sure it's fixed. He said, if I fix your car properly, in the next 100 and 150 miles or so, everything's going to test itself and the light's going to go off by itself.
And the
same, yeah, and the same thing kind of happens with the gas cap.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, I have about an 80-mile ride this afternoon, and I have to pick some people up, and then we're going somewhere. We're coming back.
Yep.
So this should not be an issue with it.
Not at all. Not at all. So
okay. It is annoying to have that little hazard thing on.
Yeah, it makes me crazy when I see that sort of stuff on. But, you know, it should go out. It should go out on its own, providing there's no problems with the gas cap. The other thing is the thing about the key not being recognized. Nissan did have a bunch of problems with that. They had some software changes they did. It could be the battery and the fob is starting to get a little bit tired. Could be a couple different things.
Okay.
One of those things you're going to have to go back to the dealer to have them look at it if it isn't something as simple as the key fob is a problem. But they've had some problems with it. Doesn't just recognize it. Next time it does it, someplace under the dash or around the dash, there's a place where you can actually hold the fob or slide it into a slot or something where if the battery is really weak, it will recognize it. So if it look around, there'll be a little spot somewhere in the dash that says hold key here or do something here, and see if it does that, if it recognizes it then the battery in the fob is probably just going bad.
You know, for a couple of bucks, I should just put a new battery in.
Well, you could do that too.
Yeah, we're only talking about $2 or $3.
Yeah, they're not too. They're sort of like a little digital watch battery kind of thing. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All righty.
All right. Take care.
All right. Thanks.
Yep.
Thanks very much.
Yep. Bye bye. 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. When we come back, we're going to have a review of the 2019 Ram pickup truck. We'll give away some tickets to the Connecticut Auto Show. Next week also, we're going to be talking to our friends from the Paragon Group about the Connecticut Auto Show. So we'll hear a little bit about that too. We'll be right back.
Road again, just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends, and I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again, going places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again.
And welcome back to the Car Doctor program. Since I'm sharing a lot of things today, we had an interesting experience at home.
Oh boy.
Oh boy. And my wife, who's probably listening, is probably not going to be happy.
Oh boy.
But she's applying for her, she worked at Stop and Shop part-time for a lot of years. And almost full-time when we first got married, and sort of 1 year less every year we've been married, to 0 years. But then she went to apply for her pension. And to apply for her pension, she needed a form of identification and her, our marriage license. And,
oh boy,
apparently it was never filled out correctly. So it doesn't have her married name on it.
Oh, no.
And she called the city of Brockton, where the marriage license was filed, I guess. And they said, well, we can't find the old records, so you're going to have to apply to change your name. So you're going to have to go to court to change your name. And she said, change my name from what? It's on my driver's license, my passport, my Social Security card is correct. They said, yeah, but it's not correct on your marriage license. She said, it had to be, because how could I have changed my Social Security number, my Social Security name, my driver's license, and my passport
without
the right stuff? And they're like, oh, that's what you're going to have to do. And I am absolutely convinced that this is going to cause all kinds of problems. Besides the $200 it costs to apparently go to probate court and change your name. But she's like, change my name from what? It's already my name. I have to change it, but I have all this official documentation. And they're like, well, that isn't what it says on your marriage license, which we never actually technically had.
Oh, boy.
We had a church certificate that said, you know, John Paul marries, you know, that. And that's all we ever had. But about 10 or more years ago, our house got broken into. And when it did, our birth certificates and marriage license were all in the same jewelry box, because, you know, we live such a high-profile lifestyle. We just had them sitting in a box. And while my wife replaced our birth certificates, she was like, I might as well get our marriage license, too, while I'm here. And never looked at it in the 10 or 15 years that we've had it. And then when she looked at it, she's like, oh, this isn't filled out correctly. And the town won't do anything about it. They're like, well, you're just going to have to change your name. And I know this is going to be a problem. So if anyone out there in radio land has ever had this problem, I'm looking for suggestions. Short of, well, I did call a lawyer, but, and she said, yeah, you might have to do that. And I'm like, I just know that, because 2 cars ago, we bought a car. And somehow, the car, we never got the title. So we called the registry, and the registry said, well, you moved to Marblehead. I'm like, no, we didn't. They said, well, the address we have is, you know, Ocean Drive and Marblehead or something. And I'm like, uh-uh. And they said, oh. I said, well, how do we get it fixed? So, because they said, well, you're going to have to pay the excise tax on Marblehead. And I'm like, we don't live in Marblehead. We live in the same town we've lived in for 40 years. So I called the town of Marblehead, got the clerk's office, very nice lady who happened to answer the phone, and she said, oh yeah, she said, I see this here. We'll just send it to you. But she said, you have to go to the registry and tell them that you don't live in Marblehead. So we went to the registry, and the registry said, well, you just do a change of address. I said, but we didn't move. And they said, well, just do a change of address, and then we'll know that, you know, you don't live in Marblehead and you live here. And then we got another tax bill from Marblehead because they think we used to live in Marblehead now. And I'm like, no, this isn't. And when my wife was explaining all this to me, we were opening up registry service in our Newton, Massachusetts office. And at the time, the registrar of motor vehicles was standing right next to me. And I'm like, hang on a minute.
Right place, right time.
Yeah. I'm like, hi, Miss Registrar. Here's my problem. And she said, Oh, yeah. We'll figure this out. So we got that figured out. But I think it would have been even more complex. But by changing our address, all it did was flag everything else and said, well, you used to live here, so Marblehead wanted the money from, or whatever. Maybe it was Marblehead. It was somewhere up that way. But it was, where's the town with the fishing shack that everybody takes a picture of?
Oh, Rockport.
Rockport. That's where we lived. We lived in Rockport for like,
a second?
Not even. We never lived in Rockport. I've only been to Rockport twice, and I've never lived there. So that's why I'm a little concerned about this whole other thing. So
I have a question regarding the new license, because my license expires in December.
Yep.
What do I need to get a license now?
Go online, download the Real ID form, and it'll tell you what you need. You're going to need a form of identification other than your license. A bill that show like a utility bill or something like that, to show that you're a resident in the Commonwealth, and I think you need two forms of identification. One of them I think has to have a picture. So if you have a passport, you're good.
So you just said two forms of identification, but a passport is technically like three forms of identification.
No, so a passport
and something else.
Yeah, credit card, I think. And something else, AAA offices do them as well.
That's what my next question
was. It takes longer because apparently all the documentation has to be scanned. And there's different scanners for different things. Mm-hmm. And if you bring a birth certificate, it can't be laminated, for instance. You know, mm-hmm. Some people laminate all that stuff. It can't be laminated because you could have forged it under the lamination, I guess, and so it can't be laminated. It's the Real ID has its own bit of problems. In fact, I tried to get the registrar, Aaron Devaney, on the show to talk about Real ID one time, and they couldn't make it for whatever the case is, and probably ought to try that again just to explain what it's all about. You will need... you will need Real ID on your license if you fly and don't have a passport, or if you go into a federal building. So if you go into a building like the transportation building in Boston, the one down by the theater district, and you park in the parking garage, for instance, if you don't have Real ID, you won't be able to park in the parking garage unless you bring a passport, I guess. So you will need it for certain things. So, and our AAA offices do it. Junior D'Amato, no stranger to this program, wanted to get his license renewed and wanted to get a Real ID. He went to our Raynham office. I called the office manager down there, Phyllis, and said, Phyllis, what time does Junior need to be there? And she said, I got to tell you, on Saturday mornings we have a line. And she said, it probably wouldn't hurt to get here by 8:30 or so. So... to see it all. Let's see. Expiring license can be used as one form. I used a passport license to prove mass residency and an insurance bill. Yeah. So you need two forms of identification and some other thing that shows you live here. So like a utility bill, electric bill, cable TV bill. Oh, you don't have cable. That's right.
That's right. Well, I do have internet.
I know. I'm just. Let's talk to Skippy. Skippy!
Hello, Doctor. I know you've explained this before, but I'm going to do the right thing and write it down this time. It pertains to jump starts.
Okay.
I believe what you said is you put the clamp on the positive, and then you don't put the negative on the negative. You put it on a piece of metal.
Yeah, okay. Okay. All you got to do is remember this. Plus to plus, minus to metal.
Plus to
plus, minus to metal.
Right. And I know you said something about if you do it, you know, the old way, it could screw up the computer.
Well, yeah. What can happen is if, for instance, the you can go directly to the top of the battery. The reason why they tell you to go to someplace metal and not the top of the dead battery. So Dennis's car has a dead battery. My car has a good battery. So I pull up to Dennis's car with my car. I shut my car off. I take the red cable and put it on the positive connection of my battery. I walk over, I put it on the positive connection of his battery. I take the black cable, I put it on the negative connection of my battery, and I go over to his car. Rather than go to the negative connection, I look for some kind of metal bracket or something. And some cars actually have a bolt that sticks up that's really designed to jumpstart the car. And so I attach it to that. And the reason why I don't attach it to Dennis's dead battery is because as batteries go dead, they start to produce hydrogen gas. And when you hook up a jumper cable to a battery, sometimes you get a little bit of a spark if a dome light's on or the headlights are on. And you don't want to make a spark around hydrogen because it could blow up. So that's why we always say hook it up to a piece of metal and not directly to the battery. You know, 100 times a day, people hook, you know, negative to negative, positive to positive, nothing happened. What you have to watch out is, generally, I won't restart the good car. I'll leave the good car shut off and just try to start it with just the voltage in the battery because I don't want to have the alternator, my alternator, cycling up and down trying to recharge the dead battery in the dead car. I'd rather get the dead car started, let it run for a little bit, and then disconnect the battery cables in the same order, negative off the dead car, then negative off of my car, positive off the dead car, positive off of my car. And then what really should happen is the car with the dead battery really ought to go someplace and be put on a battery charger, charge back up, and then test it out to make sure that battery's in good shape.
So if I have the good battery and I'm giving the person the jump, I'm going to put my positive on the positive,
yep,
and my minus on the minus, the black to black, but the car that's hitting jump is going to get put theirs on positive in the middle.
Yep.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right. Sure. Thanks, Skippy.
Bye bye.
Or call AAA. 1-800-AAA-HELP.
Likewise.
All right. Take care. All right. I promised I would talk about the truck that got me around last week, and that is the Ram 1500 pickup truck for 2019. It's been completely updated, available in short and long wheelbase models with two four-door cab configurations. There are six trim levels, and four-wheel drive is offered in all the levels. With all the shapes and sizes, I counted 29 different configurations. That's a lot of different doors and beds and motors and stuff. Our road test was in the two-wheel drive Ram 1500 Bighorn Sport Quad Cab with the 5.7-liter mild hybrid V8 engine.
Mild hybrid?
Mild hybrid.
What is mild hybrid?
It has a 12-volt battery under the hood, a 48-volt battery behind the rear seat, and something that looks like a generator under the hood. And when you come to a stop, it shuts off. But rather than like some hybrids, like some cars that shut off when you come to a stop and they start up and they feel really clunky when they restart, this starts up perfectly smooth. It comes to a stop, you feel the engine shut off, but you barely feel, it feels like a hybrid, like a Prius when you take off, because it's actually starting off on this motor that's under the hood, which is a belt drive, and what it does is it spins the engine over and gets it going. So there's no starter motor kind of going, trying to start it. It's this belt drive thing. The little electric motor also provides a teeny bit of torque and a little bit of regenerative braking when you take your foot off the gas, so it charges the 48-volt battery up. So mild hybrid, it will not run if it's out of gas, for instance,
mm-hmm.
I don't think. Can't imagine. But it's just a way to help improve fuel economy, lower emissions because the engine shuts off. So, optional on our well-equipped Big Horn Ram, whoever makes up these names, was, of course, the 5.7-liter Hemi mild hybrid remote start, larger infotainment display with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, adjustable pedals, power sliding rear window, host of other features. The 5.7-liter V8 provides plenty of power. It should. It makes all kinds of horsepower. And pretty decent fuel economy for a full-size truck. Like I said, the e-torque, they call it e-torque, the thing under the hood, offers a seamless idle stop and start. And it also provides a little bit of regen when you take your foot off the gas. It recharges the batteries a little bit. The V8 engine also has cylinder deactivation, so it doesn't always run on 8. Sometimes runs on 4. During my road test, I averaged about 22 miles per gallon in a mix of city and highway driving. All this technology didn't hugely, if there's, is that a word, hugely?
Overly?
Overly. Benefit fuel economy.
There you go.
Yeah. You know, a full-size V8 truck might get 20 miles per gallon, maybe a little less on an average. So it's kind of, you know, I guess when you look at lower numbers like that, if it went up 10%, that's a good number. But 22 miles per gallon is not bad. The 8-speed automatic transmission is nicely matched to, like I said, plenty of horsepower, almost 400 horsepower, 395 horsepower, and it delivers really nice, crisp shifts in just about every driving situation. The ride was sedan quiet. This is one of the quietest trucks I've ever been in, and the ride was really pretty nice. Handling was pretty good for a truck. Electric power steering was very positive at both low and high speeds. The front seats are super comfortable. This would be a long-distance cruising truck. It would be a really comfortable truck to be in because this wasn't the full four-door, even though it had four doors. The rear seats, I had two adults back there. Pretty comfortable, but I don't know if I'd want to drive to Michigan in it, for instance, but decent enough. I like the way the rear seat cushions actually flipped up, so you could put boxier stuff in there without having to put it on the seat. And also, last weekend when I did this program from the Cape, I have a little, looks like one of those Secret Service cases. You know, it's not the fancy, expensive stainless steel case. It's the $20 Harbor Freight metal case. And but it fit right under the seat. I lifted up the seat, tucked it under there, folded the seat back down, and it fit kind of nicely back there. So it was actually kind of nice. The cargo bed had a nice spray-on liner that, in addition to looking good, kept items from sliding around because it's a little bit rough. It also had a folding cargo cover that provided a good weather-tight seal, and it also had LED bed lights, so you could push a button and light up the bed, so if you're out there in the dark trying to find something back there, you could light it all up, and that was kind of nice, too. The Ram for 2019, with all the improvements, may be just enough to sway all those people that buy Fords and Chevys and take a look at the Ram. A lot of people say to me, who saw it, said, you know, I'm not really a Dodge guy. It used to be Dodge, but now they called it Ram because, you know, I'm not really a Dodge guy, but this is a pretty nice truck. And I heard that from a couple of people, and the Dodge fanatics, people that like Dodge products, love the truck. So, you know, take a look. Like I said, this one had the 5.7-liter V8, almost 400 horsepower. Mileage, 17 city, 23 highway. I was averaging 22 overall, so not bad. Most of my driving, probably 80%, is highway. Sometimes if I'm stuck, not so much. Yesterday, driving to Connecticut, I wasn't in this truck, but there was a tractor trailer that was rolled over, closed all three lanes except the breakdown lane. That's not a lot of fun.
Hugely is a word, by the way.
It is. Googled hugely. It. How did it, does it have, well,
it states very much to a great extent. So hugely impact. Yeah.
Did all right.
Not hugely.
Well,
impact
hugely.
It. We should go to another spot, by the by.
Why don't we do that? And when we come back, I know, it's your little version of
it's
hell.
Your timing. If you did it at 9 a.m., it would be fine. But now we're getting to the end of the show.
Well, that's okay. It'll give you something to do. All right. When we come back, we're going to give away some tickets to the Connecticut Auto Show. And I have one pair each of RV and camping tickets and Boston Auto Show tickets. So when you talk to Dennis when we come back from the break, so you have to wait until we come back from the break.
Oh, boy.
We have let's give away two pairs of tickets to the Connecticut Auto Show, one pair of tickets to the Boston Auto Show, one pair of tickets to the RV and camping show. So the Boston Auto Show, RV show, they're not till January, so don't lose them. But the Connecticut show is just in a couple of weeks. So we'll do all of that when we come back, but not before then. So don't rush. My name's John Paul. This is the Car Doctor Program. We will be right back. It's a rag-top day. Classy little white and red turns everybody's head. If you want tickets to the RV show, you want tickets to the Connecticut Auto Show, bother Dennis now, and he will hate me from now on. So, but, you know, you need something to do. He's just sitting here. You need something to do. There's a interesting article in Automotive News this month or week.
So, sorry, we're out of the Boston. We got the RV and two Connecticut.
Okay, we're out of the Boston tickets, according to Dennis. You may have just heard him say that, but just in case you didn't. And we'll have more. Don't worry. I have a bunch. But we're gonna spread them out a little bit. But if you would like tickets to the Connecticut Auto Show or the Boston RV Show, you know, you can give us a call. And Dennis will set you up. So people like Porsches. There have been some great ones. The 356 was first seen on July 1948. Over the years, the 550 Spider, a lot of people know that one because of James Dean. He died in one. Horrible way to remember a car. The 911 was the successor of the 356, which was kind of the original car. Everybody, the 911 people liked or didn't. One of my favorite cars, which people don't necessarily like, is the 912. The 912 was a 911 with the four-cylinder engine, and a lot of people, it was a little less expensive car, and it outsold the 911 by 2-1 because it was cheaper. It had a 2-liter fuel-injected four-cylinder engine in the last model year in 1976. The car that I kind of liked was the 928. That was Porsche's big departure from the rear-engine cars, and it was a front-engine V8. And it was first thought it was going to be a replacement for the 911. That didn't happen. In fact, when that car was introduced, Porsche was selling about 1,500 cars in the United States. They almost went out of business. I remember I was an arbitrator for Porsche. If a Porsche customer had a consumer issue, I would end up getting involved with it. And I remember the 928, and we were talking about the company in general, and it didn't do that well. But the 928, especially the 928 with the 32 valve engine, was a really hot car. And then there was, of course, the 924, which was kind of the four cylinder version of that, which I knew somebody that had a 924 turbo. And at the time, I think I was road testing a Volkswagen GTI, and the GTI might have actually been a little faster. So it was kind of interesting. And then the one car that really got, I guess a good way to describe it is kind of a polarizing car, was the 914. The 914 was sort of envision a Volkswagen Common Ghia. The 914 took over as the 912's role as a brand entry-level model for 1970. It was produced as a joint venture between Porsche and Volkswagen. The 914 had a sharp, edgy design as opposed to the Common Ghia, which was more rounded, but they were similar in a certain way. The 914 also had pop-up headlights, which some people over the years replaced. But it was an interesting car. And then I guess the successor to the 914.
Before you get into that, we are out of tickets.
We're out of tickets. Dennis worked his magic. We're out of tickets, but we will have more tickets soon.
Just joyous times.
Not today. Not today. But we'll have more tickets soon. But the Porsche Boxster was sort of like a reimagined version of the 914. And then, of course, there was the Carrera GT, which was the Porsche 959 was considered by some people to be the greatest supercar of all times. It produced crazy horsepower, 444 horsepower. The car went from 0 to 60 in like 3.5 seconds. A very collectible car, very expensive. And then there was the Carrera GT, which was a V10 version of the 959. And I saw one in a parking lot down in Hyannis. It's a car that just, they made very few of them, and there it was just sitting there. In fact, I don't know that the 959 or the Carrera GT were ever legal to sell in the United States. They probably had to wait until they got that old before they could bring them in there. But, you know, kind of interesting how Porsche has evolved and become really a major player in the business. And I go back to the time I was at an auto show, a Porsche show, and one of the Porsche family members was there. And it was just Porsches everywhere you could see. And he kind of went, "This makes me sad." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Half these cars came on trailers. My cars are meant to drive. They're not meant to look at. They're meant to drive and enjoy, not just for people to stare at, put it in a trailer, take it home and put it in their garage and wax it and go out and stare at it again." He said they're meant to drive. They're driver's cars. They're not meant to just stare at. So,
then lower the prices.
Well, I'm driving a car which is kind of an interesting-looking car out in the parking lot. From this angle, it looks like a Star Wars X-Wing fighter. I could be wrong.
Well, I would put it more at the A-Wing. But
A-Wing? That's okay. I don't know my Star Wars trivia like
the
you
X-Wing
do.
Looks like an X. That doesn't look like an X.
Okay, so the A-Wing looks like a A?
Well, yeah, in a way, it's sort of, yeah.
Okay.
But there's no wings on the A-Wing.
Okay. All right, well,
I especially like the blue, yellow, and white color of it.
Oh, no, not that one.
Okay,
not that
sorry.
Vehicle, yeah.
All right, take me off.
Yeah,
so I'm done.
Yeah, we'll get to you in a minute. That was Paul Sullivan, who's sitting here and helping us with all kinds of things.
How is that car to ride? Well, we'll have the review next week, right?
We'll have the review next week. But it is a the car we're talking about, by the way, is a Lexus LC 500. It's a 2018. It's actually got a lot of miles on it. It's got, I don't know, 10 or 15,000 miles on it. It's a sports car in the truest sense of the word, other than it does not have a manual transmission available, I do not believe. Yeah, paddle shift sort of things, which, they're just not. It's not as much. It's not the same. There is something very zen-like about driving, and I don't even know if that's the right term. But there is something very spiritual.
Well,
about,
yeah, zen. You're one with the car with the manual.
Yeah.
But even the race car drivers today don't use the paddles.
I'm old. I know that F1 drivers all use paddles and push buttons. That's how they work. But it doesn't seem. There's something about letting the clutch up, timing it just perfectly, getting a perfect crisp shift. There's something zen-ish about that. This car is, that's the car I drove a whole bunch of miles yesterday. It is pretty fast.
Yeah, well, we can do the review next week.
Okay. All
right. Tease it. Okay. Tease it.
All right. We'll talk about it next week. I don't think we need to tease our listeners about things like that, but okay. But we will talk about it next week. And we'll talk about a variety of other things, including some things you need to do to make sure you get your car ready for wintertime that, you know, I hate to say it, but as one of our callers and Matt Williams from Hart said, it's not just raining outside, it's cold and raining outside. It's starting to feel like, you know, we had a summer day this week.
Yeah, and that's the last one we're going to have for a while.
Think so for a while? Like I said, I woke up to my heat coming on this morning.
Oh, you have your heat on already? What kind of New Englander are you?
Well, okay. You're saying that by frugality? Is that what you mean?
No, just. I mean, I hate the cold as much as, if not more than most people, and I don't even have my heat on.
Well,
yet.
We didn't have our heat on until last week when I decided to service my oil burner.
Which of your three properties have the heat on right now?
Not the one in Florida. Not the tin shack in Florida does not have.
Michael ignore your?
Hurricane Michael. Yeah. We're being spared because of the Indian mound.
Oh,
there is somewhere in my area. There is an Indian burial site.
Okay.
Referred to as the Indian Mound.
Uh-huh.
And we've been told by people that it's the Indian Mound protects the town of Englewood from hurricanes.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I mean, what was a big storm last year that you were really worried about?
Of them?
No.
Did I mention it was a trailer?
Well, yeah, I know that, but
it was one of the hurricanes that were coming up. Think it was the one that devastated Puerto Rico.
Yeah, that one.
Maria?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and it went right through my town, by the way.
When you say through, you mean the Indian ground didn't assist or went around you?
Well, it took down the Dunkin' Donuts sign out on the main street.
Yeah, that's a great loss, especially because they're going to change those signs anyway.
Yeah. But it did. It took down. I had a tree, a pretty palm tree that's had out in front of the house.
Yeah.
And the good news is it fell over to the right.
Mm-hmm.
If it fell to the back, it would have landed on top of my uninsured piece of property.
Are palm trees heavy trees? I don't know.
They're dense.
Are they? It's pretty dense wood.
Because, I mean, the reason that they are still there in the land of hurricanes over centuries is because they're flexible.
But yeah, this one broke off, strangely enough, right at the base. So the guy who cuts my lawn, I said to him, you don't cut down trees, do you? He said, I don't cut down trees. I said, well, it already fell down. and he said, oh, yeah, I can cut it up for you.
Is the wood from the palm tree?
Serves no purpose whatsoever best I can find. Right. It looks a little mushy inside.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, again, that probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I don't know. So, okay. Yeah. So,
well, that's good.
And the guy who cuts my lawn. Yeah. Cut up the tree and didn't charge me for it. So,
okay.
Hey. Yeah. Well, having taken you on this detour, back to the cold.
Back to the cold.
Continue.
Which is,
carry on.
Which is where we'll talk about how to take care of your cars for the winter. And congratulations to Scott from Stoughton, Peter from Yarmouth, John from Boston, and Mike from Hingham. They'll all get a variety of tickets. Scott and Peter will get Connecticut tickets, John will get Boston tickets, Mike will get RV tickets, and we'll give away more over the weeks. We are going to be talking next week to, I was wrong, it's 2 weeks, 2 weeks away, I think we're going to be talking to Chris from the auto shows about the variety of shows coming up. Next week we're going to be talking to, I believe, somebody from General Motors about a true extended warranty that they're going to put on their used cars now, kind of put their money where their mouth is kind of thing, and also make their used cars more interesting for people to think about buying and thinking about dependability. So we're going to be doing that. You've heard Paul Sullivan. He's sitting there just now. He's on his phone. He's like a teenager. He's always on his phone.
I just got an email.
Oh, see, you're like a teenager. Unless you were Snapchatting or something.
I said, I don't even know what that is. But I said to you before, when we're the same age. So when we were kids, they were talking about the computers and, well, they didn't even use the term digital back then. But we'd have computers that would do everything for us. And our leisure time would just explode. We wouldn't know what to do with the time we had in our hand. That's not really happened. What happened, the computer assist is there. But now we're expected to do much more.
We are. It's
and I'm working all the time.
What was that Bruce Willis movie?
Bruce Willis?
Oh, there was more than one.
I know.
Yeah.
Die Hard?
No, but he like it was like fat and was laying in a chair. But he, but his
the fifth dimension.
No.
I mean the fifth element.
No. And he was, but he, it was like he was a cop or something. But he was this young looking cop that was out doing stuff. But really, the reality was he was in a chair and he was fat and he was about ready to explode, which has made me think of it.
Oh, that must be one of his new
like
ones.
Surrogates or something.
Yeah, something like that. I haven't seen that one yet.
I heard that one. You didn't miss. Don't bother trying to watch it. It was terrible. Hey,
yeah, but anyway, yeah, we're always working.
There's a piano guy. So what do you got going on? Speaking of working,
you have new music
you're playing today.
Yeah, I gave it a demo.
Yeah. So
it's good.
You got a lot of good stuff coming up.
I still have fun doing this after all these.
After all these years.
Yep.
That's good.
No heavy lifting.
All right. Paul Sullivan and the Irish Hit Parade coming up next. The very best in Irish music heard here for the rest of the day, starting with Professor Paul Sullivan. Talk to you all next week. Wear your seatbelt. Be good to your car. Bye.